Series is a collaboration between the United States Access Board and the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Education, National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research, NIDRR. Today's session is being recorded and will be archived, and information about that will be made available at the end of today's session. The chat area is currently closed approximately 10 minutes prior to the end of the presenters ending their presentation. The chat room will be opened again, and participants will have the opportunity to submit questions in the chat area, and you will have plenty of time to submit your questions, and the presenters will be able to answer those questions for you. So please hold on to your questions until we get approximately to about 25 minutes past the hour. For those of you needing to use captioning for today's session, you can click on the captioning icon located in the top left-hand corner of the page. So today's session, without further ado, and we apologize for getting started a few minutes late, but I'm going to go ahead and turn the session over to Peggy Greenwell from the U.S. Access Board. Peggy?
Thank you, Peter. I'd like to welcome everyone today to our webinar session on accessible play areas. Today we're going to be discussing the play area accessibility guidelines, which are now the standards under both the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Architectural Barriers Act. Next slide. Presenting the session today will be myself, Peggy Greenwell. I am an accessibility specialist at the board, along with serving as a training coordinator. I've been here since 1992, and I served as the lead staff person in developing these play area accessibility guidelines. I'm joined by Bill Botten, who has been with the board since 2000, and he also specializes in access issues related to recreation and play areas. We're going to be taking turns during the presentation, so you'll be hearing from Bill a little bit later. Next slide. Okay, just for a review, our session agenda today will go as follows. We're going to start off talking about the application of the Architectural Barriers Act and Americans with Disabilities Act standards. Play area standards. We're going to walk through some terminology that we use in the guidelines that is necessary to help you understand how to apply the provisions. We're going to move then into ground level play components and accessible routes, ground level accessible routes, followed by elevated play components and elevated accessible routes. From there, we'll move into play component accessibility, self-contained play structures, and then on to questions. We'll take questions at the end of the session, and we should have ample opportunity for that. Next slide. So just a little background about the play area accessibility guidelines. The board developed these guidelines and finalized them in 2000. And since that time, they've been incorporated into the revised ADAG, which it was finalized in 2004, also known as the ADA-ABA Accessibility Guidelines. So the new ADA and ABA standards are based on the board's ADA-ABA guidelines published in 2004. That document represents a revised ADAG, or Youth and UFES. And all the work that was going on previous to 2004, after the 1991 standard, up until 2004, was incorporated into the new guidelines. So the earlier supplements added included play areas and other recreation facilities. So what you see in these standards are the same provisions that we finalized in 2000. With different numbers and, of course, a different organization. Next slide. So the 2004 ADA ABA accessibility guidelines represents a combination of accessibility guidelines for buildings and facilities covered by the ADA, whether that's Title II, state and local governments, or Title III, places of public accommodation, and the Architecture Barriers Act facilities, or federal facilities. So what you have here is a document that includes two, Chapter 1 and 2. Chapter 2 applies to facilities covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Another Chapter 1 and 2 applies to facilities covered by the Architectural Barriers Act. Those chapters are referenced with an F in front of them. Chapters 3 through 10 are all the technical chapters, 3 through 10, and those remain the same whether it's a facility covered by the Architectural Barriers Act or the Americans with Disabilities Act. Next slide. So to begin with, we'll just do a quick review of the Architectural Barriers Act accessibility standards, which would include buildings and facilities constructed or altered or leased on behalf of the federal government. So this could include an employee daycare center at a federal building, a federal park, or other federal leased facilities. These play area accessibility guidelines have been effective as the new standard under the Architectural Barriers Act since May 8th of 2006. That's when the General Services Administration adopted them as the standard for new construction and alteration. Next slide. So recently, the Department of Justice revised the ADA regulation, making several changes to its non-discrimination policies. And additionally, they adopted the new ABA guidelines as the new standards, calling it the Department of Justice's 2010 standards. So currently, that new standard is available for immediate use, and it will be mandatory for buildings and facilities, newly constructed and altered buildings and facilities covered by the ADA after March 15, 2012. Up until that time, you're free to use the 2010 standard, or you can use the 1991 standard. That's an option until March 15, 2012. And once again, the 2010 standard is, however, available for immediate use at this time. Next slide. So up until this point, we've been talking about newly constructed and altered facilities, and now we're going to talk about existing facilities, particularly those facilities covered by the ADA. So under the ADA, in terms of the requirements for existing facilities, Title II, which covers state and local governments, requires that you meet the program accessibility requirement for existing facilities. This may not result in every existing facility being accessible, as long as when an entity views their play areas in their entirety, they would consider them to be accessible. Under Title III, the requirement for existing facilities for places of public accommodation requires that those that are covered by Title III remove barriers in existing play areas when it's easy to accomplish without much difficulty or expense, or what they call readily achievable barrier removal. Now, it's very important to understand, if you have questions about the application of the requirements for existing facilities under the ADA, that you contact the Department of Justice, and we've noted their contact number here, 800-514-0301. Next slide. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Department of Justice further addressed how to handle existing facilities with respect to the new standard. What they said is, if your facility complied with the 1991 standard, you don't need to modify it to meet the 2010 standard unless it's altered on or after March 15, 2012. So, for example, if you had accessible parking spaces that met the 1991 standard, there was no need to bring those accessible parking spaces up to the 2010 standard. Now, they went on to say that this what they call a safe harbor for existing facilities does not apply to elements in existing facilities that were not subject to the 1991 standard. Next slide. And those elements in the 2010 standards not subject to the safe harbor include, among other facilities, play areas. So basically what that means is that you need to consider the play area accessibility guidelines with respect to your existing play areas when you are achieving program accessibility as a Title II entity or barrier removal, readily achievable barrier removal under Title III or places of public accommodation. Again, we encourage you, if you have questions about the application of guidelines to existing facilities, to contact the Department of Justice at 800-514-0301. Next slide. We have on our website some guidance, some online guidance to offer, which gives you a good review of what standards apply to what types of facilities, whether you're covered by the Architectural Barriers Act for federal facilities or the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we'd encourage you to visit this site, whether you're interested in standard information for either regulation, the ADA or the ABA. Next slide. So we're here to talk about the play area guidelines, and we want to begin by noting that these guidelines that we're discussing in this session apply inside the play area. Now, outside of the play area, or in the case of this photo where you have a path accessible route that connects it outside of the play area, you have other accessible route provisions that would apply to that route. Connecting on a site, maybe the play area with parking, toilet rooms, and other elements. So you would follow the Chapter 4 of the ADA or ABA standard for the provisions that apply to the accessible route connecting the play area. Next slide. Here we want to clarify that the play area guidelines do not apply to play areas designed for children under 2 years old, for play areas where provided in family child care facilities where the proprietor resides, so in a home child care program. They also do not apply to amusement attractions or religious entities, and this is under the ADA. There's a general exemption for religious entities, so the same would hold true with play areas under the ADA. Next slide. What we also want to point out is the situation where you are building play areas in phases, and we know that this happens where funding, say, in a state and local government for an entire playground where it's a very large play area is not available within one fiscal year. They may decide in 1 year to do half of the play area and the next fiscal year to do the other half. So we've addressed building play areas in phases. Next slide. The key here is that accessibility must be maintained in each phase of development. So your initial phase may have a certain number of accessibility or a certain number of play components provided. Then and you need to meet the requirements for that particular number, then at each successive phase, the whole play area must be reassessed to ensure compliance. And in a moment, we're going to talk about the triggering events for ramp access, which will be important when you're building play areas in phases. Next slide. Where play areas are separated by ages for safety purposes, So you have a play area that's designed for children ages 2 to 5, or a preschool play area, or a play area designed for children ages 5 to 12, school age. Those would be considered two separate play areas. So when we move forward and talk about applying the provisions, you need to think of both of those as two separate play areas. Next slide. We also want to point out that if play areas on the same site are geographically separated, you would consider them to be different play areas, separate play areas. So they may be on one side of the school building, one on one side, one on the other, or they could be at different locations within a park. The important thing is that you consider them to be separate play areas. Next slide. So the play area guidelines are triggered in new construction, and they're also triggered where a play area is altered. So it's important that we clarify what is considered an alteration, thus triggering the alterations provisions, and what actions would be considered maintenance. What we're pointing out here is that normal maintenance activities, such as replacing a worn S-hook or topping off ground surfaces, are not considered alterations, thus not triggering the alterations provisions. Next slide. Alterations that affect or could affect the usability of a play area, such as removing a climbing play component, replacing it with a spring rocker, or changing the ground surfacing, those would be considered alterations, thus triggering the alterations provisions. Next slide. There's some additional requirements related to alterations when altering a primary, an area primary function, which would be most areas within a play area. Basically, what is required is that the area that you alter must be in compliance with the ADA or ABA accessibility standards, the approach of you, if you touch it, you fix it. But you're also required to spend an additional 20% of the total cost of the alteration towards the path to travel to it. So maybe you are doing an alteration to change the equipment, so everything inside the play area maybe complies with the accessibility provisions. What this is saying is that you may have to spend an additional 20% outside the play area on elements that would serve the play area, such as the accessible route, the toilet rooms that connect, or the parking facilities that are connected on the site. Next slide. To improve the safety in some older play areas, operators often move equipment to create safe use zones. A use zone is the ground level area beneath or immediately adjacent to a play structure or piece of equipment that is designated for unrestricted circulation around the equipment. This is the area where it is predicted that a user would fall or land or exit the equipment on the surface of the use zone. Next slide. Since this action would normally trigger the alterations provisions, we didn't want to discourage operators from improving safety. So we limited the effect of this action by not applying the alterations provisions. So if you're moving, if the guidelines do not apply where the ground surface is not changed or extended more than one use zone. Next slide. Another provision we added has to do when you're altering play equipment, but you're not altering the surface. In that case, the surface is not required to comply with the ASTM 1951-99, which we will talk about in more detail at a later point. Next slide. Where you're replacing the entire ground surface, it must comply with the ASTM 1951-99, or at least as a minimum for the areas where you're required to have an accessible route, or a turning space, or a clear space. Next slide. Now we're going to review some of the terms used in the Play Area Accessibility Guidelines, and we're going to begin with the definition of what is a play area. Basically, the definition of a play area is that it contains play components designed and constructed for children. So when applying these guidelines, you want to make sure that you're applying it to a play area that meets that definition. Next slide. Some other terms that we're going to be discussing include accessible routes, ground level accessible routes, elevated accessible routes, use zones, ground level play components, and elevated play components. These are all terms that are used within the provisions and important to understand as you apply the guidelines. Next slide. Accessible routes, a concept that's embedded within the accessibility guidelines, is applied to the play area section. And basically, when we mention accessible routes, we're talking about routes that are designed to provide access for individuals with disabilities. In the case of the play area guidelines, these accessible routes connect all entry and exit points of accessible play components, or play components that are required to be accessible. You see here two photos, one that has a photo of a, they both have photos of slides that with an arrow that points to the exit point of the slide leading back to a transfer system. And the photo on the right shows two slide exit points indicating the need for an accessible route in that application as well. Next slide. The next concept is what is a play component? The definition is a play component is an element designed to generate specific opportunities for play, socialization, and learning. You have here on the left a digger, the right a pull-up rings, individual using a pull-up rings, and on the right an art station. Those would all be considered play components. Next slide. Since you'll learn later on with respect to applying the provisions that you do end up counting play components to know the triggers for ramp access and transfer access, we need to clarify what is considered a play component and what is not. I'm going to begin here just talking about what is not considered a play component, and that includes transfer systems, steps, decks, and roofs. Those are all elements that are not considered play components. In this structure, the photo that you're seeing here, it shows it's a composite structure with a number of those elements. Smiley faces are indicating the play components within the structure. Arrows are indicating the elements I just described, transfer systems, steps, decks, and roofs, that are not considered play components. Next slide. The next concept is what is a ground level component. The basic definition is that it's a component that's approached and exited at the ground level. So on the left here, you see some swings. Adjacent to that are some climbers, and above on the right is a spinning component. These are all elements that you approach and exit from the ground. Next slide. Elevated components are components that are approached from an elevated level and attached to a deck. So pretty much any component that's attached to a deck would be considered an elevated component attached to a composite structure. There may be components that are attached to the ground and to a deck and could be considered ground or elevated. But in that case, you can only count it once. So likelihood of it being connected, if it is connected to a deck, then it's going to be considered an elevated component. Next slide. So you have an example here of two slides. The one on the left is considered ground level component. Even though it is what most people would think of as elevated, it is approached and exited from the ground level. The slide on the right is considered an elevated component since it is approached from an elevated level and attached to a deck. Next slide. When we talk about the ground level components, we talk about play types. So that is part of the component, or that's part of the scoping provision in terms of what's required to be accessible on the ground. So we want to highlight that what we mean by play types are those types that are identified the experience of the play that the play component is generally designed to provide. So on the left here, you see a climbing component. In the center, a spinning component. The top right is a rocking component. And the bottom right is a swing. Those are all different types of play components. We mentioned that it's generally designed to provide, meaning that if you had a straight slide and a spiral slide, we would not consider those to be two different types, just one type, that type being sliding. Next slide. So the ground level requirement, or the requirement for ground level components is one of each type of ground level components required to be accessible. So you have here a talking tube, below a manipulative play component. On the top right you have a swing, and the top bottom right you have a digger. Those are all different types, so one of each type is required to be accessible. In addition, we mentioned for ground level components, those required to be accessible, that if there is more than one, they are required to be integrated within the play area. And what we mean by this is that we expect that the accessible diggers will be located with other diggers. A portion of the sand table would be accessible to children with disabilities, along with the same opportunity for children who are not using accessibility. So we do not see the integration is to ensure that kids with disabilities are integrated in the play area and not in a separate area within a play area. Next slide. We did add an additional requirement onto the ground level components, and it's based on the number of elevated components provided. So basically, it's based on the notion that, and you will learn about this later in the presentation, that ramp access is not required as a minimum until you have a fairly large structure. And we wanted to make sure that there were sufficient opportunities on the ground to be accessible for children who were not able to use elevated components where ramp access wasn't required. So what we have here is a chart that is talks about the number and types of ground level components required to be on accessible route. So the way this works is that you look at the number of elevated components that are provided, and then that tells you the minimum number of ground level components required to be on accessible route, and the minimum number of different types of ground level components required to be on an accessible route. So for example, if you had 9 elevated play components on a composite structure, you would be required to have 3 ground level components on an accessible route. And this is important if you were only planning to put 9 elevated component or a composite structure with 9 elevated components, you may need to add these additional ground level, 3 ground level components, and they must be 3 different types. So it can't be just a swing. They have to be 3 different types. It could be a swing, a climber, a digger, whatever would make up the 3 different types. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Bill Botten, who's going to walk you through more about the ground level accessible routes that connect those ground level components that are required to be accessible.
Thank you, Peggy. Next slide, please. This slide lists the 8 different components that are part of a ground-level accessible route, which we'll cover throughout this presentation. They include surface, clear width reductions, changing level, running slope, cross slope, openings, and protruding objects. Next slide. One of the key components of an accessible route at ground level is the type of surface material that's used for the accessible surface or accessible route. This slide has a photo that shows the laboratory test to determine the accessibility of a ground level accessible route by using a ASTM standard F1951-99, which is prescribed in this standard to determine in a lab whether or not a surface is accessible. The picture is a photo of a wheelchair that has a smart caliper or a smart wheel to determine the amount of force required to propel this wheelchair across the installed surface. ASTM F1951 requires the surface to be firm and stable. It includes not only the accessible route, but cleared floor and ground spaces and turning spaces. Next slide. Additionally, accessible surfaces located in the use zone must comply with the safety standard ASTM F1292-99 or 04. Next slide, please. Accessible surfaces also need to be maintained. They need to be regularly and frequently maintained and inspected to ensure continued compliance with both ASTM F1951-99 and 1292. The slide on the left shows an individual raking the loose fill ground surface material to fill in an area where at an exit point at a ground level plate component has been depressed due to activity. Also, you need to maintain the height level of your exit and exit entrance points so that if you have a loose fill product as your accessible route or your clear ground space, that those heights for your transfer platform or your exit or entry points are maintained. Next slide. The requirement is a clear width of 60 inches minimum for the ground level accessible route. This would connect all those elements that are required to be accessible at ground level. 60 inches or 5 feet minimum clear width for the accessible route at ground level. Next slide. The provisions allow for the clear width of the accessible route to be narrowed down for a distance of 5 feet to 36 inches if there's an obstacle in the way, some type of issue that cannot be removed. In the slide that you're seeing is a figure that shows a large tree that has narrowed the accessible route within the play area down to 36 inches. Again, it can be 36 inches for a distance up to 5 feet or 60 inches. Next slide. In smaller play areas of less than 1,000 square feet, the ground level accessible route can be reduced to 44 inches in width. It also requires that a wheelchair turning space, if the route exceeds 30 feet in length, must be provided. Next slide. Additionally, the accessible route has a requirement for changes in level. Changes in level of 1/4 inch maximum are permitted to be vertical. Changes in level of 1/4 inch minimum and 1/2 inch high maximum to be beveled with a slope no steeper than 1 to 2. So changes in level greater than 1/2 inch must be ramped. The figure on the lower right shows the 1/4 inch abrupt with the 1/4 inch beveled to show the 1/2 inch allowable change in level. Again, if there is a change in level greater than 1/2 inch, it must be ramped. Next slide. The running slope of accessible routes at ground level have a maximum running slope of 1 to 16. That is, for every inch of vertical rise, a distance of 16 feet must be provided. So the running slope of all accessible routes at ground level, a maximum of 1 in 16 slope. Next slide. Cross slope of the accessible route is 1 in 48, no steeper than 1 in 48. Cross slope is measured perpendicular to the direction of travel. Cross slope is measured the same way the slope is measured for running slope. It's measured rise over run. Next slide. Openings in the surface material or where two surfaces meet cannot exceed a half inch. A passage of a sphere more than a half inch in diameter is not acceptable. Elongated openings shall be placed so that the long dimension is perpendicular to the dominant direction of travel. And the figure on the lower right shows the direction of travel moving from right to left with the elongated openings perpendicular to that direction. Next slide. Another issue to consider on your ground level accessible route is protruding objects, objects that may strike an individual that has a visual impairment or that is blind. At ground level, objects may not protrude into a 60-inch wide space, the accessible route, below a height of 80 inches measured from the accessible ground surface. This requirement applies only to the 60-inch ground level accessible route and is not required for the entire play area. Next slide. From here, we're moving to elevated play component requirements. An elevated play component requirements is that at least 50% of the elevated play components that are provided must be on an accessible route. And we're going to discuss the two different types of accessible routes that can be provided to elevated play components. Next slide. Slide 51 shows the minimum number of elevated components on two different types of structures. Again, 50% of all elevated play components in the play area must be reached by an accessible route. If the play area or play component, the large play structure, has less than 20 elevated play components, access can be provided by a ramp or transfer access to equal that 50% or half of the elevated play components. On composite play structures with 20 or more elevated components, access of a quarter of those elevated play components required to be accessible must be by ramp. The other quarter can be by either ramp or transfer system access. Next slide. Providing ramp access to at least 50% of the play area, play components on the elevated level will require no additional ground level play components required. Earlier, Peggy talked you through a graphic that showed if you provided a certain number of elevated play components, there may be an additional requirement to provide more at ground level. This requirement says that if you provide ramp access to at least 50% of those elevated play components, no additional ground level play components will be required. Next slide. We talked about the elevated accessible route. There are two ways to accomplish that. First, by ramp. Second, by transfer systems. Next slide. The elevated accessible route width is a minimum of 36 inches in width. Exceeded where possible. Anytime that you can provide a wider accessible route, where in this picture shown on the right, that two individuals using mobility devices could pass, it increases the opportunities for more kids to play on the structure. We talked about that some reductions are permitted, but that a minimum of 36 inches clear width on an elevated accessible route where wheelchair access is provided. Next slide. That elevated accessible route can be narrowed to 32 inches in width, permitted for a 24-inch length to accommodate features on the composite play structure. In the graphic shown, the photo, it shows that two of the large support columns reduce the width of the accessible route down to 32 inches. Again, 32 inches for a maximum of 24 inches in length is permitted. Next slide. Similar to what we talked about on the ground level accessible route, openings greater than a half inch are not permitted on elevated accessible routes. Elongated openings shall be placed so that the long dimension is perpendicular to the dominant direction of travel, similar to what we talked about on ground level accessible routes. The opening criteria only applies when elevated access is by ramp. Next slide. Changes in level is similar to what we talked about at ground level. Changes in level of a quarter inch high maximum is permitted to be vertical. After that quarter of inch vertical, the next quarter of an inch must be beveled at 1 to 2, not steeper than 1 and 2. Where changes in level are greater than a half inch, they must be ramped. Next slide. We're going to move into ramps now. The figures that you see here are two different ramps, one on the left with a young girl heading down from a composite play structure, and then a large, on the right, a large composite play structure that has quite an extensive accessible, elevated accessible route with also additional ramps. Next slide. So the running slope of a ramp, providing access to an elevated structure with a maximum running slope of 1 to 12. For every inch of vertical rise, you must go out 12 inches. Next slide, please. The ramp rise is the vertical amount of distance the incline or slanted surface ascends or descends. In the play area, the maximum of 12-inch vertical rise for each ramp. In the built environment, you're permitted to ramp 30 feet or a vertical change in level of 30 inches. In the play area, I must highlight here that the maximum is 12 inches of vertical rise, so the longest ramp you would have is 12 feet. Next slide, please. Those ramps require handrails, and they need to be continuous within the full length of the ramp run. The gripping surface with a circular cross-section must have an outside diameter of 0.95 inches minimum to 1.55 inches maximum. There are no extensions required on the handrails at the top or bottom landing of handrails provided in the play area. Next slide. Handrails are required to have the top of their gripping surface 20 inches minimum to 28 inches maximum above the ramp surface, and the handrail, the clearance between the handrail gripping surface and the adjacent surfaces equals an inch and a half minimum. Next slide. Edge protection. Edge protection can be provided in two different ways. It can be provided where you extend the deck 12 inches minimum beyond the face of the handrail, or you provide a curb or barrier within 4 inches of the ramp surface. Next slide. Turning space. We talked about that a turning space may be required at ground level, but also may be required in elevated accessible routes. The figure on the right shows two different ways to provide a turning or maneuvering space. A turning or maneuvering space is defined as a space required for a wheelchair to make a 180-degree turn. At least one turning space must be provided on the same level as an elevated play component. The one on the upper right shows a 60-inch minimum turning circle. The one on the lower right shows a T-style turn. Next slide. Landings. Landings are required at the top and the bottom of elevated ramps. If a ramp changes direction, the requirement for the landing size is 5 foot by 5 foot or 60 inches minimum in each direction. If the ramp the landing is on a ramp that does not change direction, the landing must be as wide as the ramp leading to it, to the landing, and 60 inches minimum in length. Next slide. Crosslope, measured similarly to the ground level accessible route, must not be steeper than 1 in 48. Crosslope and slope are measured in the same way, the surface perpendicular to the direction of travel. Next slide. Turning spaces, landings, and clear floor or ground spaces may overlap. This can greatly reduce the size of your decks or your landing areas. As you see in this photo, a child manipulating the steering wheel, the turning space is outlined within the photograph, and the clear space is also part of the route. So the turning space, landings, and the clear floor to ground space may all overlap on an elevated accessible route. Next slide. Transfer systems. Moving from ramps to transfer systems, the components of a transfer system are the platform itself, the transfer steps, transfer supports, and the clear floor or ground space needed in order to make that transfer. in the photos you see in this slide, we have a transfer platform and steps on the far left. We have a young individual that is transferring straight on, trying to get onto a transfer platform in the middle. And then we have, on the far right, we have a series of several children that are working their way up a transfer platform of different size and different dimension. You can see that it's more rounded than the others that we've seen here squared. So next slide, please. So we, just to recap, we said that where there's less than 20 elevated plate components, you may use a transfer system instead of a ramp to connect that at least 50% of those elevated plate components. The photo shows you a small composite plate structure that has a transfer platform leading up to the deck to gain access to those elevated plate components on this structure. Slide 70. Transfer systems consist of a transfer platform and transfer steps. This allows for individuals to leave their mobility device and crawl or ascend or descend to this elevated structure. So we're going to go into the key components of a transfer system next. Next slide. So the minimum size for a transfer platform is 14 by 24. And you see in the upper photograph on the left side where a piece of cardboard has been cut with those dimensions, and you can see that this transfer platform has been produced larger than that 14 by 24. And any time that you can provide greater space for an individual to maneuver outside of their mobility device, it'll provide greater levels of independent access. This transfer platform is mounted between 11 and 18 inches above the floor or ground surface, and the 24-inch or long side of the transfer platform must be unobstructed or be free so that an individual can leave their mobility device and either park straight on or parallel to this and then accommodate that for transfer. Next slide. Transfer steps, a minimum size of 14 by 24 inches wide with a maximum height of 8 inches. Sometimes 8 inches can be a difficult transfer for very young children, so a maximum of 8 inches with, again, each step being 14 by 24. Next slide. One of the key components of being able to transfer independently is a transfer support, and we don't specify what that transfer support is made of. It could be a hole in a panel. As you see in this graphic here, these photographs, we have a large a pipe structure that has more like a grab bar or handrail type product being used. We don't specify the location of these transfer supports, but they can greatly increase the opportunity for young people or even caregivers that use mobility devices, the opportunity to transfer safely and independently. Next slide. The clear floor or ground space adjacent to a platform. We don't specify the direction of this, but the long side, again, of the transfer platform, 14 by 24, the 24-inch side, must be free and clear and available for transfer. But that the clear floor or ground space is a minimum of 30 by 48 inches and is part of your accessible route. Next slide. Slide 75 talks about the distance between the transfer system and how you design that. By limiting the distance of where an individual gets on a composite plate structure and where they discharge, and the distance between, as you see in this photograph, the distance between crawling over from the bottom of the slide back to the transfer platform, if you can minimize those distances, it greatly provides more independent access and more usability by people with disabilities that have left their mobility device to get back over to the transfer platform and ascend back up to do the slide again. Next slide. Where transfer systems are used, you can connect elevated plate components with an elevated plate component. This slide shows a crawl tube that's being used to connect one side of a composite plate structure to another. So again, you can connect elevated plate components with a plate component where transfer systems are used. Care must be taken in this. all types of access. Sometimes it may be very difficult for individuals that are crawling or pulling themselves across certain types of element. It might be a lot more difficult. So care must be taken in the type of element that you use in order to connect these different elements. Next slide, please. Accessible play components. We're going to talk about the clear floor or ground space, entry points and seats, play tables, and advisory reach ranges. Next slide. The play component, accessible play component guidelines require that they be integrated, that play components be integrated, similar to what Peggy talked about earlier, that persons with disabilities have the opportunity to integrate and play and socialize and interact with children without disabilities. And so those play components must be integrated throughout the play area and not separated. Next slide. The clear floor ground space is 30 by 48 inches, as I earlier mentioned. It's discretionary about the placement of the clear floor ground space, but imagine yourself when you're defining these, and if you're mixing different types of surface materials, it can become very important about how you lay out the opportunity for a person to transfer. Not everyone likes to transfer the same way, and so the discretionary placement of how one would use or manipulate, as you see in the photo on the far right, an individual has pulled their power chair up to a steering wheel with a look-through panel. This would be a very difficult one to place with a parallel clear floor space. People are going to want to come straight on it and act like they're driving. So this applies to the ground level and elevated components accessed by a ramp. Next slide. Entry points and seats. 11 inches minimum and 24 inches maximum above the clear floor ground space is where you would place your entry point or your seats. Mid-level height of 18 inches is more recommended, but care should be taken on to the age group that you're providing play area for and the heights of where your seats, the access or entry points and discharge points are on your accessible play components. Next slide. Play tables for ages 5 years old and over require knee clearance with a minimum of 24 inches in height, 30 inches wide, and 17 inches deep. The top of the rim, 30 inches, 31 inches maximum. You can see in the photograph several children in mobility devices having the opportunity to play with sand at a height where it is accessible to them. Next slide. Play tables for the 5 and under, you may provide a parallel approach instead of the knee clearance if the rim is a maximum of 31 inches in height. Next slide. Reach ranges, recommended specifications for locating the features that someone would operate are provided. And whether you provide a forward or side approach, these reach ranges are in the next slide. So next slide. You can see that based on the age group, the reach ranges increase. From 3 to 4 year olds, we're looking for reach ranges anywhere from 20 to 36 inches in height from the clear floor space. 5 and 8 year olds, it moves from 18 inches a little bit lower, but a little bit higher also up to 40. And if you're an individual between the ages of 9 and 12, we expect that you could reach somewhere between 16 and 44 inches. So we're talking about any of those elements on a play component that you would need to manipulate or operate or move. So reach ranges are advisory. Next slide. Water play components, ground level access and transfer access to elevated water play components is required. So it would require that a route be provided through the water and a transfer access, no requirement for ramps, even though with an aquatic access wheelchair, ramps may provide additional access and independent access sometimes for individuals that may not be able to leave their mobility device. But ground level access and transfer access to elevated play components, water play components is required. Next slide. self-contained play structures. These are play structures made of one or more components where the user enters a fully enclosed environment that utilizes pliable materials. You find these a lot in Title III facilities. Transfer system is permitted, and we base the level of accessibility by how many entry points there are. So three or fewer entry points require one on an accessible route. Where there's four or more entry points provided, two must be on an accessible route. There are no requirements for a transfer platform inside of this contained structure. Again, many of the elements that we talked about could greatly increase the opportunity for persons with disabilities to use these independently, such as the reach ranges, such as the height of the steps, transfer steps, but those are just recommended. They're not provided within the standard. Next slide. A couple of resources for you is first, that there is a guide for the ADA accessibility guidelines produced by the Access Board that walks through and I think is a really good resource for existing play areas to be able to identify and understand and give you a little table to be able to count the number of play components both on a ground level and elevated level. So these are free of charge and available from the Access Board, the Play Area Guide. We also have at the Access Board's website an interactive play online course. And there's always the availability to call our toll-free technical assistance hotline at 1-800-872-2253 and or email the Access Board at ta@access-board.gov for additional help in understanding the play area guidelines. Next slide. At this time, we're going to take some of your questions, but we'd like to highlight on the next slide that where to direct your questions. And many times through our technical assistance line or through the TA line, we receive many questions about implementing regulations or additional requirements or the requirements for existing facilities under Title II and Title III. We'd like you to direct those questions to the U.S. Department of Justice at 1-800-514-0301. Or if you have questions about the 2010 accessibility standards for new construction or alterations, please call the Access Board at 1-800-872-2253 or reach us by sending us an email at ta@access-board.gov.
All right. Thank you very much, Bill and Peggy, for all of that that great information. At this point in time, participants can submit questions, write their questions in the chat area, and we'll turn it back over to Peggy and Bill to begin to answer those questions that participants have put into the chat area.
Okay. Thanks, Peter. This is Peggy again. And we did have an opportunity for people to submit questions before the today's session, and so we thought we'd start with those, which will give people an opportunity to submit some further questions in the chat area. One question that came in, actually there were several questions related to existing facilities. Someone was describing their town that presently has no compliant playgrounds. All have had reconstruction in the last 5 to 10 years. Basically, you know, what's a reasonable number of playgrounds to be accessible in this case? And we just want to remind you about the portion earlier we discussed existing facilities. And the new standards apply to newly constructed and altered facilities, play areas. Existing facilities are treated as they have been under Title II and Title III. Under Title II, existing facilities are required to achieve program accessibility. Title III entities are required to achieve readily achievable barrier removal. So I'd really encourage you to, because this is not within the authority of the Access Board, again, we focus on new construction and alteration, you need to consult with the regulation, and I would actually encourage you to read Section 35.150, which deals with existing facilities under Title II. There is some specific language about what that is, what is meant by that. and also encourage you to look at the full regulation, the full revised regulation, where there is what we call the preamble, which includes a wealth of information about the Department of Justice's position related to existing facilities and some of the public comment that was received during the time when this these guidelines or the regulation was being amended. You can also contact them, as we've mentioned, at 800-514-0301. Another question came in about how do you evaluate and what considerations should be given to natural play elements. Basically, the play component guidelines would apply to natural play components as well as manufactured play components. In fact, that was what was intended when they were developed. So basically, you would look at the various element that you're addressing. And look at the clear space requirements. If there's an entry point or a seat, follow those provisions as well. In terms of how do you determine the fall zone, that's basically the highest point where a child might fall from a piece of equipment that would be considered your fall zone. And these are, I would refer you to the ASTM safety standards for playground equipment. In terms of the type, that, you know, basically you would look at the different types as we talked about earlier, climbing, spinning, whatever experience that that component you think will be providing would be how you would address, how you would consider types. Someone also talked about the information sheet where it talks about the standard and the effective dates, and I just want to review that once more. The 2010 DOJ accessibility standard is replacing the 1991 standard, and it is effective and mandatory after March 15, 2012. Up until that time, you can use either the 2010 standard or the 1991 standard. So the 2010 standard is available for immediate use. Another question came in about the maximum gap allowed between transitional surfaces and this person actually submitted a drawing of a situation where they have basically a transition with a transition between a turf product and concrete. And what they're pointing out here is that they have a 5/8 inch gap. And what we want to point out is the provision that does not permit more than a half inch opening. So that would be what would be required in new construction for this condition. Another question was about play areas with multiple swing bays. How many swings would be required to have a clear ground space of 30 by 48? The minimum would be one, but that clear space or the space required is more than a clear ground space of 30 by 48. What's required at swings is actually a turning space. So it's a 60-inch diameter or 60-inch diameter circle or a T-shaped turn, T-shaped space, which is a 60-inch square with arms and a base 36 inches wide. Another question came in about what our thoughts are on the New York City's ranking of playgrounds in terms of accessibility. It really is not our place to comment on this ranking system used by the New York City. It's not something that's required by our guidelines, and it doesn't in any way relieve an entity of the obligation to address accessibility of existing facilities. This is just something that they have developed and are providing for information purposes. There was another question about, Let's see, what should public school districts know about the new accessible play area guidelines, regulations? What steps should they take to encourage compliance? I think participation in opportunities like this, where you're learning more about the accessibility guidelines, is very important. And as I mentioned before, understanding the regulation. You really need to put this together with the regulation, particularly when it comes to existing facilities. And then I just want to refer to a few questions that came in before we began the program. There was a question about religious entities, and we noted this in our session. There is a broad exemption for religious entities under the ADA. So the regulation actually does not apply to religious entities. And then another question came in about what kind of happened. Did something happen in 2006? And we can understand why you might have some confusion here just with respect to the play area guidelines, because they were developed and finalized in 2000. At that time, we were adding them on to the previous standard, the 1991 standard, so there was a whole different set of numbering, a number system and format being used. So that work was completed in 2000, and then in 2004, or kind of simultaneously, while that effort was going on, the board was also engaged in revising the 1991 standard and developing revised ADAG. That was what was published in 2004, so you had the revised ADAG in 2004. So we folded all of the play area guidelines that were finalized in 2000 into the 2004 document. And then in 2010, what has happened is those guidelines have been adopted by the Department of Justice as the 2010 standard. So that's kind of what has happened chronologically with respect to the play area guidelines. Now I'm going to turn it over to Bill to respond to some of the questions that have come in the chat room.
Several of the questions have talked about indoor play areas, and the standard does not discriminate between either indoor or outdoor or exterior, and so the guidelines for play area would apply to indoor play areas also. Do the ABA standards mentioned apply to military child care centers? The answer is yes. The Department of Defense has adopted the Architectural Barriers Act accessibility guidelines that do include the play area guidelines. So yes, military child care facilities would be required to comply with the guidelines that we've just talked about. Do existing water slides need to be made accessible? The guidelines don't specify water slides. The recreation facility guidelines did require an accessible route to the catch pool of water slides, but the water slides are not specified at all in the play area guidelines. It says, is loose fill surface material always accessible? The requirement for surface material in the play area, as I spoke earlier, has a couple of different ASTM reference standards that are used by the guidelines. The first is that ASTM F1951, which is the accessibility requirements, and currently is a lab test that's being conducted. The second is ASTM F1292, which is the fall attenuation test that determines safety. And thirdly, ASTM F1958. 1487 requires surface materials within the use zone to be fall attenuating and accessible. So the requirement for the surface material within a play area requires that surface be regularly inspected and maintained. And as you can imagine, if the surface material has an opportunity to be displaced by activity or use, that maintaining and inspecting regularly could be an issue that needs to be done very frequently, whereas a unitary surface may not need the same level of inspection or maintenance. But there are loose fill products that do meet all of the reference standards in ASTM and can be used as part of the accessible route. Again, the requirements for an accessible route connecting elements and spaces in a play area that are required to be accessible is where the accessible surface needs to be. So connecting those elements, as we talked about at ground level, is one of each type. And on the elevated level, at least 50%, and those discharge points or entrance points for those type of components would need to be connected by an accessible route, which would then need to be the ASTM F1951 and 1292 if it falls within the use zone. The rest of the surface material could be a number of different surfaces that could be loose fill, could be unitary, could be a completely different types of surface. So are loose fill surface materials always accessible if they're regularly maintained and they do pass the ASTM F1951? Yes, they can be accessible. Are wood chips still acceptable ground surface? And yes, if I would say no for wood chips, but yes for engineered wood fiber, a processed wood product that is loose fill can provide an accessible route if it is maintained and inspected regularly. Are there separate requirements for schools? No, there are not separate requirements for schools. The schools would need to comply with the Department of Justice's Title II, which the standard for play area guidelines, which are standard, is what we've just discussed. A question, is Braille required on a number or alphabet panel? We don't specify Braille as part of in the guidelines to provide additional help for persons with that are blind to understand or manipulate the panel. I do think it could be a positive thing, but it is not a requirement. Do the guidelines apply to parks who receive grant monies? The answer to that would be yes. Typically, your funding source may require the requirement to comply with the guidelines, but also that park is under Title II, which would have a responsibility through the Department of Justice's standard. A question came in on ground level slides, and the question is the ladder okay? And on the ground, a ground level slide would be a standalone slide. Remember, an elevated component would be one that's attached to an elevated deck or structure. So a ground level slide would be one that's standalone. There is not a requirement for transfer steps to the top of a ground level slide. A ladder could be used. But your accessible route would need to connect that entry point, and your accessible route would need to connect that discharge point and provide a clear space adjacent to both of those. A question came in about funding sources. The Access Board doesn't have a list of funding sources for play areas. Is grass or lawn an accessible surface for an accessible route? That's a hard one. We have not evaluated grass or lawn to meet the ASTM F1951 standard. And so at this time, I would probably say no, it hasn't been, at least as far as I know, tested to comply with the ASTM reference standard. And so I would probably say that it wouldn't meet the fall attenuation requirements if it was inside the use zone for sure. That's another important consideration, is that we've been talking about inside the play area, but it's very important that these play areas be connected outside the play area so that an opportunity for persons with disabilities have an accessible route to the play area itself. Another question, can transfer platforms be in a regular shape as long as it incorporates the minimum rectangle of 14 by 24? And the answer is yes, while permitted, providing odd shape or textured type transfer platforms may decrease some of the usability or independent operation of a transfer platform. They can be used as long as the 24 inside of a transfer platform is free and clear from any obstruction and allow a person to transfer on to the device. Getting to another question here. How can I get copies of the ASTM standards that apply to play areas? The copies of the reference standards are available from the American Society of Testing and Materials, and they're located in West Cohonkin, Pennsylvania. And if you go to www.astm.org, and there you would be able to purchase the specification ASTM F1292-99 or 04, which is the standard specification for impact attenuation of surface systems under and around playground equipment. Another standard, reference standard that we talked about that defines the use zone is ASTM F1487-98, the standard consumer safety performance specification for playground equipment for public use. And finally, the accessibility reference standard is ASTM F1951-99, standard specification for determination of accessibility of surface systems under and around playground equipment. A question came in that is, does topping off play surfaces trigger the replacement of an accessible surface? No, topping off a surface, a loose fill surface, is routine maintenance and doesn't trigger the replacement of an existing play surface with an accessible surface. Changing the surface type or replacement of the surface would require an accessible surface along accessible routes located within the boundary of the play area, including the entry and exit points of the ground level play components required to be accessible, as well as the clear floor ground space and maneuvering spaces.
There was another question here about where several swing bays connected together. Is it a requirement to have two like swings in a two swing bay, two bucket swings in a bay, two belt swings, two accessible seats? That is not a requirement under our guidelines. Basically, what we talk about is making sure that the swing is accessed by an accessible route, that there's a turning space adjacent to the swing so that there's a sufficient accessible surface underneath the swing and next to it for someone to be able to use it. So we do not specify the type of swing that is used in the swing bay. The same person mentioned accessible seats. We are aware of several products out on the market that provide back support and generally just more support in terms of the swing. That's not something that is required by our guidelines. Again, it's something that is an added feature that would provide additional support for someone, a child with a disability that might be using the swing. Let's see. We're still open here for questions, and we're trying to make sure we get to answer as many of them as possible. Changing an S connector is considered maintenance. What about changing the ring of the connector hooks into it? I believe this would also be considered a maintenance. You're basically changing it because I'm assuming it's worn out, as opposed to replacing the swing or replacing the surface. Let's see. If an accessible path made of unitary surfaces within a play surface with loose fill, does the sides of the pathway have to meet a certain slope? Not sure I quite, I think what you're asking is where there might be a change in level between one surface moving to another. I think we were explaining that earlier, that where you do have any change of level that's greater than a half inch, you need to treat it as a ramp And there you have a maximum 1 in 12 slope for that transition. So I believe that's what you were talking about here. Bill, do you have any other questions? Okay, here.
What about vandalism replacement? Would that trigger compliance? It depends on what you have vandalized. Typically, that would be routine maintenance, and you would be returning the playground to its original condition and not adding something new. And so unless you were changing out the whole surface, if that vandalism required you to completely change your surface material or something, it would probably be considered maintenance. Is F-1951-99 historic, and the most current is ASTM F-1951-09B? Are we to use 99 or rely on 09? We currently reference 1951-99, not 09, so I would recommend at this time you follow the historic of 1951-99. Should overhead play components such as track riders, ring ladders, monkey bars, chin-up bars be lowered to the recommended reach ranges? Overhead play components that are required to have their entry and exit points connected to an accessible route are not required to be lowered to be considered accessible. It's recommended that where possible, providing one component or an element of the same component at a lower height or multiple overhead components at varying heights would better accommodate children with a variety of abilities. And remember that we talked about, based on the age group of the playground you're trying to provide for, there are advisory reach ranges that could help in determining where some of those overhead issues are placed. Are ramps or transfer systems or stairs permitted to be counted as play components? No. During the presentation, we talked about that the guidelines do not permit steps or ramps or transfer systems, decks or roofs to be counted as play components.
And I think actually probably can just deal with one more question here in terms of our time. This was a question I realized came in a little earlier. Are manufacturers of playground equipment heavily involved in the design and supply of accessible equipment? It's a good question because many of the playground equipment manufacturers were involved in the development of these guidelines back in the late 90s. And there are products out there offered by many of the playground manufacturers that are accessible and do meet the provisions, but remember, it doesn't stop there. You've heard the specifications for the various pieces of equipment with respect to some of the dimensions, you know, if there's an entry point or what the clear space requirements. So there's a whole lot more that happens in addition to the equipment where it's laid out, how these elements are connected by an accessible route, how the surface is maintained, how it's installed. Those are all responsibilities of the operator who purchases that equipment and is operating that playground that is covered by the ADA or the Architectural Barriers Act. So there's a lot more involved than just purchasing the equipment. You know, you have to look at the whole picture. So I believe that's all the time we have for questions, and I want to thank everyone for their participation and remind you of the resources that Bill mentioned in terms of getting technical assistance here at the board. Our toll-free number for technical assistance is 800-872-2253. That's 800-872-2253. We're available from 10 Eastern Time to 5:30 Eastern Time, every day but Wednesday. And I think you'll be surprised at the level of the technical assistance that you can receive here at the board, and particularly in the area of play areas and recreation facilities. So I think that is the conclusion of our presentation.
All right. Thank you very much, both Peggy and Bill, for all of that that great information. And please, if your question was not answered today, please make use of the contact information that Peggy and Bill provided. You'll find it on slide 89 of today's presentation. Following shortly after the session today, you will be receiving an email with a link to an online evaluation form for today's session. We truly appreciate your feedback. It helps us in evaluating how we are doing with the accessibility online webinar series. So if you'd, we would truly appreciate you taking a few minutes to complete that evaluation form and submitting that and sending that back to us. Just as a reminder, the audio archive as well as the text transcript from today's session will be posted to the Accessibility Online website in approximately 2 weeks' time. You will have an opportunity to go listen to that and access the presentation materials that were provided today. Just as a reminder, our next Accessibility Online webinar session will take place on January 6, 2011, Accessible Residential Housing. The presenters will be looking at the application of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Architectural Barriers Act, the Fair Housing Act, as well as Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act as it applies to residential housing. So again, on behalf of Peggy and Bill, we truly appreciate your participation in the online accessibility webinar series. To get more information about upcoming sessions and to register, and when you do register for sessions, you can submit questions in advance, and those are the questions that are handled first during the question and answer period. You can find all of that information at www.accessibilityonline.org. Or you can give us a call at 877-232-1990. Once again, thank you very much for joining us today. To exit the webinar system, simply close out your internet browser. Thank you and have a great day.